This is Anna Snipes, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Ms. Gloria Glover-Gates. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Ms. Gates, you are in Eads, Tennessee, about 30 miles away from Memphis. Is that correct?
Well, about 15 miles.
15? Okay. Gloria, could you start with some basic biographical information, like when you were born and where you were born?
Well, let's see. I was born in Union City, Tennessee, which is north of Memphis. That was August 8th, 1945. And my family, my mother and dad, moved to the Memphis area when I was about 3 years old.
Okay.
My dad eventually became an airline pilot here in Memphis. We came down for his work.
Oh, okay. And what was your childhood like?
It was wonderful. My parents were wonderful parents. And as I said, my dad was a pilot. He started out with Southern Airlines, which became Republic, which became Northwest.
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of awesome opportunity to fly because we would go on trips with my dad. And my mother was awesome. My mother was one of the first people here in this area to have any kind of open heart surgery, because my mother had rheumatic fever as a child because of strep throat, which eventually led to her having a heart valve transplant, one of the very first in the Memphis area. So she was a pioneer.
Yeah.
I think my dad was a pioneer. And I don't think I mentioned he was in the Army Air Corps, and he taught other pilots to fly.
Okay.
He had started flying airplanes as a teenager. Did some crop dusting in this area, and I grew up in this area, in the Memphis area.
Uh-huh. Now, was your father, was he in the Army in World War II?
He was.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But he was, because of an arm injury when he was a child, he was not able to actually go overseas. So he taught flying at Emory Riddle during that time.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
Well, I have a brother, David, and I have a sister, Melanie. Melanie lives in Montana, and David lives about 2 or 3 miles from here in the Lakeland, Tennessee area.
And what sort of school did you go to?
Well, I went to schools, of course, Shelby County Schools is what we call them here in this county, and graduated from Whitehaven High School, and then I went to Blue Mountain College in Blue Mountain, Mississippi. It's in North Mississippi, and at that time it was a college for women. Men could come, but they could not actually stay on the campus.
Uh-huh.
It is now a co-ed school. A fine school, it's a wonderful school, and that's where I was first introduced to the American Red Cross SRAO program, because they had sent some brochures, and they were put up on the bulletin board in our gym.
Oh, wow.
And I was able to see them there.
Okay.
But I had a very good background. I did major in English, elementary education, and physical education, so I had quite a background for what I did over there.
And when you were in high school and in college, were you aware of the escalation of the conflict in Vietnam?
I think at the time that I was in high school, we were more concerned about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Uh-huh.
Because I can remember even us having assigned places to go in case they received a warning. And I was assigned to the girls' locker room in the gym. That's where I was to go if the alarm ever went off. And we were told at that time that we were not going to be able to go home to our families, because it would take more than 30 minutes for the buses to pick us up and take us home. So we were going to just be there.
Yeah.
We did a lot of studying at that time about what would happen if a bomb hit Memphis or hit the Memphis Arkansas Bridge. So we were really more concerned about that. Vietnam was something that I guess the teachers talked about, and I guess we talked about, but it really didn't. We weren't focused on that at the time.
Okay. And why did you choose Blue Mountain College?
because I had a Sunday school teacher when I was, I guess, in the fifth grade, who was a Blue Mountain graduate, and she talked about her college and how much it had meant to her. And I knew from fifth grade on that's where I wanted to go to school. And I had a counselor in high school that was telling most of us girls that we needed to go and work in department stores.
Uh-huh.
And I remember telling that lady then, no, I'm going to college, and I'm going to Blue Mountain College. And I think she was a little shocked, but
yeah.
That's what I did. And I planned from 10 years old that I was going to go to Blue Mountain College. And I loved it. It was wonderful. It still is.
And did you have support from your parents in that?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, they were very, very... I would be the first of many after me that would go to college. But I'm the oldest grandchild in my mother's family. My daddy was an only child, so there were no other cousins that I had to compete with. But
yeah.
I was the oldest grandchild on my mother's side, and so I was the first to go to college.
Excellent. Do you have any particular memories of college that stick out?
Just how wonderful it was and how precious and sweet the people were there in that community. And I just had a wonderful 4 years. I'm just so thankful for that my mom and dad could give me that opportunity to do that and get an education on top of that.
Yeah.
I knew at that time that we women had to prepare in order to go out into the world and do what we wanted to do. And I was just always seeking a new adventure, and that was another new adventure.
And in general, how much did you know about American foreign policy at that point when you were in college?
Not much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think many of us did. And we didn't get bombarded with the news like we do now. I mean, the news media now goes through everything in such detail. But we didn't really know a whole lot. And like I said, there was more emphasis on what was happening with us and Cuba and the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember vaguely that, there were things going on in Vietnam and that the president had sent some advisors over there, but I didn't really realize until my junior and senior year how much it had escalated, junior and senior year of college, how much it had escalated, and that we did have a lot of troops over there then.
Mm-hmm. Were you aware of any protests around that time?
I may have been, but I really think to me they seem to have gotten started while I was over there, while I was actually working in Korea and Vietnam. I think that's when they really got to go, as far as I was concerned, because no one around where I was, and in North Mississippi, they didn't do that. They supported whatever was going on with our troops. They were very supportive, and they were very supportive when I came home.
Yeah. So when you first became aware of the American Red Cross and the Supplemental Recreation Activities Overseas Program, what did you first think about it?
Well, you see, I grew up watching the John Wayne films of being in the service and all the different things he did on Friday nights, because my mom would let me stay up on Friday nights and watch all those. And I just grew up loving the military, loving what they did for our country and we're still doing. And so the idea of being able to work with our military, I honestly did not want to be in the military, but I wanted to serve in the military if I could and do something for them. Because my granddad had been in the Navy, my daddy was Army Air Corps, and there were so many in our church that were military or had been military. And I just loved it. I just loved the thought of being able to help in any way that I could. And it was just a one-year commitment, so, and the travel that was involved, and I just thought it just sounded something like it would be a most wonderful experience, a wonderful opportunity, if I was qualified to do that. I had to find out if they wanted me.
Uh-huh. What was that process like?
Well, like I said, I saw the brochures and the pamphlets on the bulletin board in our gym, and so I took down the information from that and requested, you know, an application, and they did. They very quickly, I got the stuff back. This was in my senior year, and I was about to graduate, and I was, of course, prepared to be a teacher, if that's what I was supposed to do with my life. But I sent this off, and pretty soon I got information back, and I filled out all of the applications, sent it all in, and the next thing I know, they're asking me to come to Atlanta, Georgia for interviews. And so they flew me to Atlanta, Georgia, and I was there for about 3 days, downtown Atlanta, and went through their interview process, which also included, I think, some psychological evaluation and health evaluations and different things like that. And then very soon after that, they offered me the job. And I was at that time requesting to go to Korea, because I was doing that for my parents' sake, because they weren't too thrilled about me going to a war zone.
Yeah.
And so I agreed to go to Korea. And from there, I had spent the summer getting all my shots and physical exams out of the way and getting a security clearance. I remember going to the downtown post office here in Memphis and being fingerprinted, and see, that was a new adventure.
Yeah.
And so we just, and I understand that some people in my church were actually interviewed about me as far as me getting that security clearance, and people at my high school, and I forgot who all, there were some people that mentioned to me that they had been contacted in reference to me, so that made me feel pretty special.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was just a whole new adventure. It was exciting, and all my friends at school were just, they couldn't wait to hear day by day, you know, what was going on next. But it was wonderful. And then, of course, I ended up going to Washington for the 2 week training and getting my uniforms and finishing up with my inoculations, because we had to go to the Pentagon and to finish up what our requirements were for, medically, for our trip over. So that was awfully special too. And being in Washington for 2 weeks, so I'd never done that before. So country girl gone to the big city, it was great.
Yeah, and what was the training there like?
Well, it was almost like college. We had to go to class day in and day out. We had to learn about, of course, the American Red Cross. We had to learn about the SRAO. We had to learn about what our jobs would be. We had to learn about programming and how we would create these programs that we would be taking out into the field to share with these men. And so much of the programming and preparations programming was very similar to what I'd been doing in school, preparing to be in front of a classroom of students. We had to do, it looked like just like a lesson plan. Each time we created a program that would be used by the entire unit as they went out into the field. Anything they needed as far as props or whatever, and it had to be able to fit inside of a canvas bag, which they showed us how to do that. And it was awfully good preparation. But of course, you still learned a lot by actually being in the field and participating. But we were also taught about the military protocol and what we could and could not do, and things as far as our safety was concerned. And I just remember there was a lot coming at us in 2 weeks, but it was awesome to be in that situation, and in that beautiful building there in Washington, which was the headquarters for the American Red Cross. It still is a beautiful building. I think so many of us went around with our mouth wide open for a long time, because we were just overwhelmed by what we were experiencing.
Yeah. Were your instructors in the program, had they returned from Vietnam and Korea?
I'm really not sure their background. I know that so many of them had been with the Red Cross for a long time, but I'm not sure how many of them or which ones had actually been in country. but I do believe there were a few that came through during the two-week period who had just returned from one or the other country. But I couldn't tell you specifically. But I do know that they were all experienced members of the American Red Cross who worked for the Red Cross for quite a while. In fact, they gave us a notebook. I don't know if you all have a copy of the notebook they gave us. But it was more or less our training manual.
Okay.
And I think if so many of them are like me, we kept a box that contained a lot of these things and kind of carried them around with us every time we moved from place to place in Korea or Vietnam. And some I know have said whenever I've been with other girls with her, they've lost those boxes with all that memorabilia in them because various things that have happened over the course of these many years. But I still have mine, the notebook they gave us. And it's just full of mostly things about the American Red Cross and all the things that they wanted us to be able to answer questions if we were ever confronted or asked about the different services of the Red Cross.
Great. And what did your instructor say about your purpose in heading to Southeast Asia?
Well, they explained to us that we were over there at the request of the military, our Army. Asked us to come, Air Force, Navy, Marine, to actually be of service to the men in the fact that we were presenting ourselves as reminders of home, reminders of mothers, sisters, wives, girlfriends. We were there to talk with them when they wanted and to listen to them when they just needed comfort, but we were also there to bring them a little joy in their day, that they could look forward to our coming and that they would enjoy our presence. And we did do programming. We did a lot of programming. We visited hospitals. We visited anywhere that it was safe for us to go to. And to be perfectly honest, we went to some places that were at times dangerous for us to be there. But the men protected us. They were so careful of us. I never really felt scared. Except when we were back at our places, our billets where we lived, and we were under a mortar attack. That was the scariest time.
Oh, yeah.
But we were requested to be there, and so we went. But I never felt like that they put us in any danger, deliberately put us in any danger, because we were there for the morale of the men, and the men appreciated us. The ones I was with appreciated us.
Did you have any hesitations about going?
No, not really. Trying to think, when we were getting ready to leave, of course I was in the Korea group, we had to go to Tacoma, Washington, and I was not feeling well at that time. Mm-hmm. I picked up a little sinus problem, and so we got to Tacoma, Washington, and we had to wait for a week in Tacoma, Washington, because we had to wait for another troop flight over to Korea. And there wasn't one leaving for a week, and so we had to stay in a hotel there in downtown Tacoma. And I had to go and find a doctor because I really felt bad. And I really thought, you know, maybe I need to go home. Maybe I need to go get some help at home. But I got to feeling better. It was all right. It was just a typical sinus infection. And so I got over it, and by the time we were ready to leave, I was ready.
Yeah.
But you know, when you feel bad, sometimes you just want to be home with Mama. And but I got okay, so I was fine. That was really my only time. And we went, of course, we flew into Japan, and then we refueled there, I guess that's what we did, and then we went home to Seoul.
Uh-huh.
And went through the little training period there for a few days before we were assigned our different units. So that was a little side trip that we got to take.
Yeah. Did you take a civilian plane over, or was it a military plane?
Oh, no, it was military.
Okay.
The only time I flew civilian for that whole year was if we were doing anything, I'm trying to think now, I don't want to tell you incorrectly. I guess because anytime we went R&R, or anytime we moved from one country to the other, we were on flights with the men going in. And when there was another girl that transferred to Vietnam with me, and we were on a, we were picked up by a flight going from, that had refueled there in Tokyo, and was going from Tokyo into Vietnam. There we got on a flight with men. And, I mean, coming home, I think I was one of, one other woman, I think, may have been on the flight beside the flight attendant. And so we were constantly with the troops. I was trying to think if coming out of, I got to go R&R to Hong Kong and also to Australia. But again, we were with troops. It was a military flight because we did not have to, when we went R&R, we did not have to pay for that. The only, I take that back. In Australia, I got to fly on a little small airplane, it was the biggest, because I did have to pay for the ticket then. Because we got to go and visit on the sheep ranch while we were in Australia.
Oh, wow. And what was the mood like of the men when you were flying over? Was there a difference in those going to Korea versus those going to Vietnam?
I really didn't perceive anything like that. I really couldn't tell you that. They were just awfully young, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
And for so many of them, because I mean, I was 22 years old by that time, and they were. Some of them were 18, 19, and it was just remarkable to me how young they looked. But they were awfully, awfully nice to us anytime we were with them. True gentlemen.
Yeah. So when you first got off the plane on in Korea, what were your first impressions?
Oh my goodness. Well, I just remember all of us that were going at that time were on that plane. And the only thing I can remember, really, as we were driving in from being picked up, and I guess we were in a van or a station wagon, as we drove down this four-lane road, every once in a while we would see a man actually going to the bathroom on the side of the road. And now that was a little startling.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
None of us had really ever seen that before. But after you've been there a while, you got used to that. You know, that was just what they did. It just took us a little while to kind of get used to the way that they did there. But they were the sweetest, finest people. And we did get to, you know, have more to do with the Korean people. Because it was safe for us to go out into their villages and ride on their trains and all that. So, it really was.
And where were you stationed there?
I was at 28th Field Support Group, Camp Humphreys. And it's, I think, about 30 miles. It's on the coast, about 30 miles. South of Seoul, and we did get to go to Seoul on a few occasions, you know, when we had to do something special, or I remember going up there and spending the night in a nice hotel for something, I don't know what exactly it was, but we got to go there and spend a night, and it was a little bit better, you know, than where we were actually living there on the base. I understand now Camp Humphreys is a very nice place now. And the wives and families are able to actually be with the men there now. They were not when I was there.
Yeah.
It was strictly just all male military and us and the nurses. That was it. And we lived in Quantico.
Did you travel around the country, or did you stay close to the 28th Field Support Group?
Well, we traveled. That was our job, that we had to go out. We did program there on Humphreys if they wanted us to, if we were invited to come. But we did travel a lot by train and by truck. And times we flew, because we would go, one of our trips was to Kunzan Air Force Base, which is on the coast there, and when we would get there, we would arrive, you know, we would travel by train and jeep or truck, but then going back to our base, sometimes we would literally hitchhike on an airplane or a helicopter if it was going back to Humphreys. And so however we could get back, we'd get back. We were really good at hitchhiking. But, you know, we really didn't have any trouble either, because, sure, we'd be glad to take a couple of American girls back.
Yeah.
Sure, come on. And so they'd get us, you know, back to base. And had the experience of flying on different types of aircraft while we were over there, because, you know, most of the really big new stuff was in Vietnam. So Korea had kind of some of the leftover stuff. But the train rides were wonderful, because we got to, the people were fascinated with us. You know, they just couldn't get over us. And so those that knew English or were learning English would want to talk with us. And, of course, we were carrying donuts, because we had to carry boxes of donuts. And our baker would tie them all together so that we could carry them on and off the trains. And we also had our bag of our program that we were taking out that week. And they were always fascinated, because they would know exactly when we were coming. And we'd get off the train, and usually one of the boxes of donuts was left behind, because we would always have to pass those donuts out to the children that would meet the train.
Yeah.
And they knew that the girls would come that particular morning of that week, every week. And so they were always there to meet us. And they were so cute. And the people were lovely. And I've befriended quite a few of the women, and even invited some of them to come and visit me on our base. And met some of the girls that they were just so sweet and so fine. And the men, I had a couple that the young man was our rock, the military equivalent over there in Korea. And he had actually come to Jackson, Mississippi many years ago whenever he was a youngster, and representing Korea at a church convention that was held there in Jackson, Mississippi. So his English was very good, and he was now in the Korean military, and he was assigned to our unit there on Humphreys. And he and his wife would invite me and anyone else I wanted to bring out to have a meal with them in their little house out in Pyeongtaek, which was the village right next to Camp Humphreys. And they were just lovely people. I just enjoyed so much. And I even went to their church on Sundays, because I'd asked for somebody. If somebody will come and take me to church on Sundays, I'll go with them. And he was the one that stepped up and volunteered. And so we would go to church at their church. And I would sit on the side with the ladies. And, of course, he would have to sit on the side with the men. But that's the way they did in their church. But didn't understand a word that they were saying. But when we sang the hymns, I understood the hymn, because I knew the tune. So. But I thoroughly enjoyed the Korean people and being there.
What a wonderful experience.
Well, and the men were great. And we got to go to, Kunsan Air Force Base, but then as we were traveling to Kunsan, we would go to our missile sites and batteries along the way. Because, like I said, this was on the coast, and so we had a lot of that. I guess we still do over there, but at the time, too, I don't think any of us realized the significance of the people that we were being introduced to, or the places that we were actually seeing. The tremendous amount of military that we have there, but what wonderful work that they're doing, and still are, and how important it is that we be there. And that keep a watchful eye in that part of the world.
What was the attitude of the men in Korea about your presence there?
Well, they seemed to appreciate us being there very much. I know that some, just like in any situation, anywhere, there were some that felt like that we were there just for the officers, that we seemed to spend more time with the officers. But when we would come on site to an area, we had to be careful about where we were in a situation that might put us in harm. And there were some times when, of course, we always had to go to the to one of the officers' billets, because that's where they would set up a place for us to go in, and if we needed to dress or if we needed to use the restroom or something, we would go to their area to do that. It would not have been okay for us to have done that in the enlisted personnel's area, so sometimes they would get unhappy about that, that we seemed to gravitate towards the officers. But I mean, I think most of the men appreciated us being there, but there were always, and there always will be, some who will feel slighted. But our main purpose, of course, was to be with the enlisted, and we tried always to do what we could with those men and see as many as we could while we were anywhere we were for that day or for that visit.
Do you have any particular memories that stand out about your time in Korea?
Oh, goodness. Well, I can remember, of course, the pictures that I sent. I don't know if you've looked at any of my pictures.
Yes.
I did take a lot of pictures of Camp Humphreys, of the base there. And, of course, if any of the aircraft that we got to go in and fly into. I do remember one time coming back from Kunsan that we were in an airplane that the type that has the motor, the engine, the propeller was right on the front of the plane. It was a small plane, and it was, I don't know how many it held, maybe five or six total. But I just remember we were in a storm, and it was bad. It was a bad storm. And it was a little fearful that the pilot was going to be able to get us back, you know, to Humphreys. But he did. But it was just a situation that I knew my daddy would be proud when we finally got back.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to take pictures of a lot of the aircraft, any type that we flew in, because daddy would like to see those. There was an incident where while we were at Kunsan one time, for some reason, the girl that I was with, she ended up going, we had to return to our billet where we were actually spending the night there at Kunsan. And she was going with somebody somewhere. And so I was left to get back to our billet, which I couldn't tell you now how far it was. But there was a sergeant who was there, and he said he volunteered to take me back to where we were spending the night, to our billet. And so I agreed to go with him. He tells me as we're driving along in his Jeep that he needs to stop and pick up something at his billet. And so it starts to rain. And so he asked me if I want to come inside. And so I went in to get out of the rain. And while we were in there, he began to talk to me as if, you know, perhaps we could get along a little better than we are, and perhaps things might happen. And
yeah.
He was suggesting that I might spend the night there with him. And, you know, being from this little girl who's just come out of an all-girls school down in North Mississippi, I really, at first, didn't have a clue what he was talking about. This is the first time I'd ever had a man to approach me in this way. But I simply told him, no, I've got to get back to my billet tonight. If you would be nice enough to get me back tonight, I would appreciate it, because I really don't need to stay here with you. No, I don't need to do that. And he was... This could have been something that I could have really gotten in a lot of trouble with if he had decided to force himself on me, but he did not. He turned around and we went back outside. I got in the Jeep and he took me where I was supposed to be. And I appreciate that. And that was just another time whenever I felt like that God's hand was on me and protected me. And I appreciate that man, even though he had other thoughts. But I said no, and he agreed.
And about how long were you in Korea?
I'm sorry?
How long were you in Korea before you
I was there
Vietnam?
From the end of September until after Christmas, right into January. I'm not going to be able to tell you the exact dates, but I got to, I'm not sure the exact date of Tet offensive, mm-hmm. but I was there. I was in Vietnam by Tet.
did you make that decision when the call came for volunteers to go to Vietnam? What were your thoughts about that?
Well, we some way, I'm not sure how it happened, but they sent a request down from Seoul that they needed some girls to transfer to Vietnam because they had to send some girls home. Because, you know, there was a lot that that Red Cross would not put up with as far as behavior in the country. Of course, we knew that going in. And also, if you got sick enough that they felt like you needed to go home, you didn't need to stay in country. And so I think there had been some sickness, and I think there had been some behavior situations. And so they asked if any would volunteer to move. And I did. I just, you know, this is great. I'll go. Of course, I don't remember exactly what happened to get us what we needed or to get us to actually move, but another girl and myself flew out. I guess we went to Tokyo. And while we were in Tokyo, we had to stay there for, I think, 3 or 4 days. And I was able to meet up there in Tokyo. It just so happened that a friend of mine who had been at my college for a few summers, because we'd met there in summer school, and she was with a USO group coming through Tokyo, and they were on their way to Vietnam. And so we were able to spend a couple of days there with that group of young folks that had just come out of Arkansas, and just had a wonderful time, and, you know, went all over Tokyo and just had a great time. And then, of course, I was put on a flight. She and I were put on a flight. Soldiers coming from the States and going into Vietnam. And when we got there, we both had our uniforms on from Korea with our raincoats. I mean, we were ready. But when we got off that airplane, it was like 97 degrees.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing they neglected to tell us. And it did take a little while for them to get uniforms to us. But there, they wore nothing but the top and culottes. And our winter uniforms that we were wearing in Korea had to be packed up and sent home because we didn't need them anymore. And I remember the airport there, Kamsanut, and I remember going through their security check. And then they took us to a hotel in downtown Saigon. And I think it was the one they used for all incoming civilian personnel. And we went through a training period there of about a week, and then they moved us to our unit. And of course, it wasn't long after we got there that Tet happened, and people back here in the States were hearing all kinds of news, you know, and awful things. And I wanted to get a hold of my mother and dad and let them know that I was okay, because it took about three weeks, for mail to get home, and then about 3 weeks for mail to get back to us. So I wanted to get in touch with them faster than that. I believe, make a phone call to them, a long-distance call from Tokyo, and that was a good thing, because once I got to Bearcat, it was horrible trying to get a hold of anybody at home, because we had to use the radio, CB radio, and that involved about 6 people across the world listening in on your conversation, and my mother understanding that she had to say over every time she finished whatever she was saying. And then they had to get back to me, who I had to say something, and then I had to say over. It was really a hard conversation to have. So most of my long-distance phone calls were whenever I was out of country somewhere and could get to a real telephone.
What were your parents' impressions? You mentioned that you had chosen Korea at first in order to allay some of their fears. What did they think about you switching to Vietnam?
Well, I'm not sure. I think they were okay with it, if that's what I wanted to do. But they knew how we were taken such good care of in Korea. So that kind of softened the blow, because the military transported us everywhere we went and provided for our where we lived, mm-hmm. and they fed us, you know, if we weren't eating with the men. We did receive a little salary from the American Red Cross, but most of us sent it home, because pretty much everything was taken care of for us. because we were American Red Cross workers, but we were working on the military had requested that we be there, and so they appreciated it and they took care of us in that way. So they were okay with us. They just wanted us to be safe and wanted me to be safe, and like I said, I never felt unsafe except when we were being fired on.
Yeah. What had the American Red Cross told you about Vietnam before you arrived?
Well, you see, I didn't go through that training.
Yeah.
Because I was in a different group, so they kind of, you know, taught us a little quick history lesson. And we had to understand, you know, of course we did that with Korea. We understood. They tried to help us to understand why we were in Korea, why we were still there, and what we were doing and what we were hoping that we would be able to do for the people there. And the same thing with Vietnam, you know, was a quickie there in Saigon of how we got there and what was going on there and what we hoped to accomplish. And of course, we were in the middle of that city that was very bustling, and I just remember the smell. I don't know if you can understand what I'm talking about,
uh-huh.
but the smell of Korea and then the smell of Saigon, they were distinctly different and yet distinctly the same.
Uh-huh.
It's just a different odor than I've ever been associated with, and I didn't realize that odor again or that smell again until I went to the fair here in Memphis after it had been going on for about 6 or 7 days.
Oh.
And then it's funny the things that you remember or that distinctly come back to you after you've been in a situation like that. But because there was just so much vegetation there in the city like we don't have here, unless you go to a farmer's market, but there was vegetation all over Korea and also in Vietnam. And the people, just bustling with people, and the sights and sounds and smells of that big city. And I understand now that the city is so much bigger than it was.
Yeah.
And than it was. And of course, there were a lot of areas where the war had done a lot of damage to that city. After we got there, we could see the damage that was already been done.
And where were you stationed?
In my first time when I left Saigon, they sent me to 9th Infantry Division. Bearcat was the name of the place. And I think I'll label those pictures for you. It literally, I believe they had gone in and just taken out the jungle and then flat area there, where they could build this base that at times I think there were like 3,000 there on the base. The buildings were all just wooden buildings. Our building, of course, was an L shape. It reminded me of the Holiday Inns back in those days. It had a fence around with one entrance that was for our protection. And, of course, we were right next to a helipad. And so it was just not the best place to be, you know, on a base, especially for us women. But there were troops there from all areas, but we did have a large contingent there of helicopter pilots, both the Chinook and all different types of helicopters. I can't remember right now the names of them, but we did fly in and out of there a lot on the helicopters. We would hitch a ride wherever we needed to go, and we'd find a helicopter that was going there, and they'd take us. They were great about doing that, but General Ewell was our commanding general at that time, and right outside of Bearcat, which of course had a perimeter, and was constantly guarded, there was a Buddhist orphanage, which we did get to visit while we were there. We tried to do things that encouraged the people to like us, those in that area, but we were really not near a major city or anything like that. And Bearcat was, it was just a great place to be, but there were places on the base itself that we women just knew we weren't welcome to go because it was strictly, whatever it was, had been established for the men and for their use, and so we didn't go there. The swimming pool, there was a, let's see, I can't remember what they called it, but they had a place where the men could go and take special baths and all this kind of stuff, and we understood that there were women there also that we didn't need to go there. And I only remember actually riding in a Jeep around the base late afternoon. It wasn't safe to do that at night. Just riding in an open Jeep, just listening to all the sights and sounds of the base, but it, we were under a mortar attack a few times while I was there, and so we had a, when I got there, we didn't have a bunker, but while I was there, they did build us a bunker inside of our fence. We did have an armed guard on the entrance to our billet, which was necessary because at one time we had a soldier who, after becoming very, very inebriated, he came in, climbed over the wall and from one room to another and actually attacked the girl. After that, they put barbed wire on our ceilings above our, below the roof, but above us, so that no one could climb through. And like I said, we had the armed guard who protected us. But we understood that it was not, you know, that's the same type of crime happens anywhere you are in the world. But that type of thing, we understood these men were coming in from the field. They were drinking heavily, and a lot of them did some very foolish things because of their alcohol. At the time I was there, drugs had not gotten to be the problem that it became later in 68. But most of this was an alcohol problem, because I must say that the military did make sure there was lots of alcohol and lots of cigarettes in Vietnam.
What were your living conditions there at Bearcat like?
Well, not plush, you understand. Like I said, it was an L-shaped building, and each of us had our own rooms, and we had a shared bathroom. There were showers. The showers, the water came from 50-gallon drums that were up on top of the building, and they would be filled by the water trucks that would come around. Sometimes the water trucks would be used before they came to us. They would be used to transport Agent Orange or the kerosene or the fuel that they used for the helicopters. And so we always detected some kind of smell in our water when we would be bathing. And some of us, our skin became quite irritated and our hair became quite irritated from the water that we were having to use. We had a large room, we called it our living room area, where we could meet. There were couches and chairs in there, military issue, of course. And there was a bar, and we could invite, you know, guests to come in and visit with us. Now, if anyone was traveling, any women were traveling with a USO group, or for whatever reason they were coming through, and they stopped off at Bearcat, they would stay with us in our village. But each room had a bed, Army issue bed. We had a little end table beside the bed, and there was a little, what I call a dresser, and that's where you could unload your suitcase and put your clothes in that. We had a mamazon who took care of our clothing, our washing, and we paid her, I think, the equivalent of $5 a week to do that. And so, depending on how many of us there were, she made a pretty good living. As far as they were concerned, and I think, I did tell you that we had a bunker there, which we would have to go to as soon as we could, you know, somebody yelled incoming, and here we'd go, and sit in there until it was over, and at night we could hear the B-52s bombing the surrounding area, so sometimes you went to sleep with that sound, We had mosquito netting on our beds, which saved us from the mosquitoes. Not air conditioned.
Yeah.
Nothing was air conditioned. Unless you've got to go to Cameron Bay for a week or two of TDY, and they had air conditioned house trailers. It was nice.
I bet.
Uh-huh. And of course, we stayed, everything pretty well stayed coated in dust. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, we were right next to the helipad, and there was dust all the time. I mean, it was all the time. So you kind of woke up sometime with a dusty mouth. But you just got used to it. After a while, it just was something you were used to. At first, it was kind of, oh, me, you know. But after a while, you just got used to it, and that's the way it was. And then, of course, you get on the helicopter and fly out with the doors wide open. The helicopter blew it all off, so you were okay. Just tried to keep our hair. All of us, we cut each other's hair, and all of us tried to keep everybody's hair as close cropped and straight as we could, because you didn't. It was a waste of time to try to really spend a lot of time rolling it. Now, I did. My mother did send hairspray, but she sent hairspray. She didn't send the actual cans of hairspray, because you couldn't do that. So she sent the lady that did her hair here in Memphis area, got her some lacquer, and she sent us lacquer with a little pump that we put on it. And we were able to, when the girls and I wanted to, we were going somewhere nice, like General Ewell would invite us sometimes to his special occasions at the officer's quarters, and we would go and eat. It was usually when somebody important was there, was coming to eat with the general, and he would want the ladies to come too. And we would try to fix ourselves up a little bit, and we'd spray our hair, you know. And then we'd get in on the Jeep and ride over to his Jeep. Wonder why we even bothered, but... But it was nice to have hairspray. And my mother also sent chocolate cupcakes one time, Hostess chocolate cupcakes. And the girls always looked forward to my mother's care packages that she would send, because she did an awesome job of that. And I do remember that a young man out in the field that we were visiting got a birthday cake. And the birthday cake had been put in the bottom of a box. His mother had left the top of the box open, but had covered it with some kind of clear plastic so you could see the cake when you looked down in the box. And do you know that cake got to him in the field in Vietnam, completely intact?
That's amazing.
Yes, but see, they could see it, and so they very, very carefully handled it all the way to Vietnam. Because they knew where it was going.
In general, what was the reception like from the men at Bearcat?
Well, we did program there at Bearcat some, and there was a small field hospital there that we would go, and, you know, that was our assignment for that day. So the men were coming in from the field, and they were taking a few days, you know, out of the field there at Bearcat and resupplying and seeing the doctors there and whatever they needed to do. So they were already used to us. So it was, you know, it was nice. But, and we did have a VX there, so we would go and do some shopping, and they would see us there. So it was not anything like, they didn't receive us, I think, as the men did in the field. The men in the field were so glad to see us, but they couldn't believe we were out there.
Yeah.
And we were standing out there on those fire support bases in those blue dresses. They couldn't believe we were doing that. And then we would serve their meals out to them in their field kitchens, or we did visit the USS Benoit. That's the only name of any ship that I can remember going to. I know there were others, but I remember the USS Benoit on the Mekong River, and we would visit the Mobile River Marine Force. We would go in and out of Don Tam, which eventually became home of the 9th Division, and we would visit the hospitals there, and there were nurses there, and we would go and we would go into their billets and use their facilities there, and if we needed to rest for a little bit, we would go there because that was where the women lived there at Don Tam. But they had a pretty big hospital there. But Don Tam was hit a lot, too. And sometimes we would go down there, and the hospitals were particularly hit hard. And some of them were the inflatable type haunted huts. And when they were hit with any kind of mortar fragments, of course, they would immediately go down flat on the ground. So, but I remember visiting them there, visiting troops there, and there was a landing strip there. So going to Dongtown was a pretty big trip for us, and we would go down there and stay. And I did get food poisoning down there.
Oh, no.
So I do remember that. It was an egg and ham sandwich, and I got it right after we arrived that morning off the helicopter. So I said, I hadn't had breakfast before. We had to get something. So we went into the mess, and I asked for that sandwich, and within just, it wasn't any time at all. I was really sick.
Oh, no.
And so I had to stay in the nurse's quarters until we could hitchhike on a flight going back to Bearcat. And that's the only time I've ever been sick on an airplane, and I didn't want my daddy to know. He would have been so embarrassed. but I really had a legitimate reason. We had another girl that got sick on one of those same trips. She ended up having to go to Long Bend and stay 2 or 3 days in a hospital. And that was a little different. When one of us had to go and stay in a hospital, the nurses would have to rig a special place for us to be, because we had to be in our own little private area. But they didn't have private areas for women, so they had to rig up something, you know,
yeah,
so that we could be there. But I never did have to go to a hospital. But they did. The military was good about keeping us up on our shots. Of course, we were to take malaria pills as often as they told us to, and the water was nasty, I just have to tell you.
Yeah.
The water, I can remember even in the train, came to us in those big containers that you see on the back of, they were fuel containers back a long time ago, but they hung them on the back of jeeps. Well, that's how we got our water there in the train, and it tasted like iodine to me.
Yeah.
It had so much of whatever they used to purify it. So I just couldn't eat. I couldn't drink the water. So I drank a lot of Cokes that year. And I brushed my teeth with Coke. Because we had lots of Coke now, let me tell you. They sent a lot of that over there. But they also sent a lot of alcohol. So I just couldn't get over how many. They handed out cartons of cigarettes to the men. They handed out. I mean, the men could get all the alcohol they wanted. And I hated to see that, because a lot of the young men developed some real serious problems because of that.
Yeah, away from home for the first time.
Right, and seeing things that they never thought they'd ever see.
Yeah.
And the injuries. And I was able to, in the train, we visited the hospital there. The weekly, I saw troops from Quezon. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes.
And so many of them were burned. They were burn victims.
Oh.
Napalm was used a lot. And so many of our men were hurt from the napalm, even though it was intended for the enemy.
Yeah. In terms of your experiences visiting the hospitals and when you got sick, what was the relationship like with the nurses, between the Donut Dollies and the nurses?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I remember just always being so glad to see them, but they were always so busy that I don't remember ever really having any time to sit down and socialize with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it depended on the individual nurse and the individual Donut Dolly, you know, how they were going to respond to one another. It'd be just like a couple of girls on a college campus, how you respond. But they were busy. They didn't, and I mean, they were doing some awesome work over there. I mean, it was awesome. And we didn't experience the things they did in any way, shape, or form, and see the things. And I just had such respect for them. You were in awe of them. Or even fearful of them. You wanted to make sure you got out of their way so they could go and do what they needed. But we did not billet with them in that respect, because there were no nurses actually billeted in our area there, 9th Division. And then when we go to downtown, which was the bigger hospital, those girls had their own place, but we were only there using their facility while we were on the base doing our whatever we were doing there, you know. I just don't remember. I mean, most of the other women that were in Vietnam that I had anything to do with were, one was a secretary at the embassy, and I met her coming back from Hong Kong. And she invited me to come and stay the night in her apartment, which was across the street from the embassy. You know, I'll talk to a stick, you know, you give it to me to talk to. But, so I was, it was easy for me to talk to these women. But there were times whenever you knew that she's too busy, I need to get out of here, I need to get out of her way. And then there were other times that, you know, they were very receptive, but I don't remember anyone specifically sitting down and talking to me long enough for me to know where they were from and, you know, what were their experiences like and all this. I just don't, because I don't think we ever felt like we needed to take up their time.
Yeah.
Because when they were off duty, they needed a rest. For their own personal needs, you know, and we didn't need to be in their way.
Did the men in the hospital, did they feel well enough to talk to you?
Oh, yeah. Some of them did. Some of them were very sick. But some of them, we would write letters for them because they couldn't write. Some of them, they dictated to us the letter. Some of them just wanted us to talk to them. And we talked about the same thing. You know, we knew that when they talked about Friday night football, we knew what they were talking about.
Uh-huh.
So we would reminisce about those type things and their girlfriends and their first car, or if they were from anywhere near where we were from, and the football games or the basketball games, or the, it was just, you know, they were talking to a woman that when they talked about things from home, we knew what they were talking about. And we could share the same memories. And I did run into one man who I went to high school with.
Oh, wow.
And that was in a motor pool and on the base there in the train. Of all the men that I was around, he was it. So, and he graduated with me from Whitehaven. But I guess that out of 500,000 men, that's pretty good.
Yeah. What are the chances? So what was your basic day like when you were out doing programming?
Well, we would leave as soon as we were told the night before, usually, what time that the chopper was going to be leaving. We would have to be over there and ready to board the chopper with our big duffel bag and our cameras. Of course, I carried a camera everywhere. I only lost one, dropped it out of the helicopter.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I hope it didn't hit anybody, but anyway, we would ride with them, and we would, in coming back, we would literally have to tell the guys there, wherever we were, wherever firebase we were on, we would say, now, if you could find somebody that's going back to Bear Camp. And so they would, you know, as helicopters were coming over, they would let them know that there were two round eyes here that needed to get back to Bear Camp. Anybody want to pick them up? And we never had any trouble getting back. Sometimes it was getting awfully late because we were supposed to be out of there by sundown. We could not be down there after dark. Because I think that's when the most enemy activity would happen. But we always got out of there. It was always good. I know there were times in country that some girls, it was close, you know.
Yeah.
And there were certain helicopters we were not to fly in, but we were told we were not to be on the helicopter with body bags.
Yeah.
And I know some girls ended up being on helicopters with body bags, but we were not supposed to. Just like we were never supposed to be seen or had a picture taken with us holding a gun.
Yes.
Of any kind. But we were non-combatants. And that could be used against us, you know. And of course we did. You know, of course, I just followed the rules because I was raised up to believe authority is authority. So that was no problem for me.
Yeah.
I tried to be a good girl.
Yeah. So when you traveled in country, you were on helicopters. Did you ever travel by jeep?
We couldn't do that. The only time we were actually in a jeep on the ground was, our truck was on the base there at Bearcat, or in Saigon. Mm-hmm. We could actually drive around in a jeep. So that's how I got to see the city, either that or overhead from the helicopter. So I took a lot of pictures of Saigon from the helicopter. But we were not, like the girls would come through with these USO groups, or different groups would come through, and we'd tell them, please do not go on the ground. Get yourself in a helicopter to go wherever you're going. Do not go on the ground. And they were, while I was there, there were some people killed because they were out in trucks. Were ambushed and they were killed. So it was just not safe that we ever be on the ground in a moving vehicle. So we flew everywhere. Now when I was moved to Matrang, and Matrang was kind of a reward because I stayed at Bearcat longer than just about anybody ever had. Because I was there from January to the end of June. That was a long time to be at Bearcat. Bearcat was not the plush place to be.
Yeah.
As far as, no air conditioning and no palm trees or anything. So it was considered rough. But I did go TDY, like I said, to Cameron Bay. And do you know who Vicki Lawrence is?
I do not.
All right. Well, she was Carol Burnett. You know Carol Burnett?
Yeah.
All right. Well, the girl that was on her show that kind of reminded me so much of Carol Burnett, but she had her own show after the Carol Burnett show. She was a comedian too. Anyway, I was sitting in the mobile home one day. I guess I was taking a break or something, I don't know, but the door opens and in walks Vicki Lawrence. None of us fell off the couch.
Oh, wow.
Because I recognized her. I knew her from television. But she was headed to the bathroom real fast, so we didn't have time to speak. But she was there with the USO group.
Did you get to go to the shows?
Yes, we did. We were expected to be there.
Oh.
And if we were there, I didn't get to do Bob Hope, but I did James Brown.
Uh-huh.
He came to Bearcat. President Johnson came to Cameron Bay, but they always had all the girls to line up in the receiving line. We were kind of the decoration.
Yeah.
But I wasn't. I didn't go out and do that when he came. I wasn't around for some reason. I don't know. But anyway. And I think there were some other shows, but I just remember James Brown. Because that was a loud show, I mean.
Yeah.
I don't remember who all the other entertainers were with him, but I remember James Brown. And he was good. And the guys thoroughly enjoyed it. But only the guys that had come in for a few days could actually go to these shows.
Yeah. When you were doing programming, what sort of programs did you do out at the fire bases?
Well, we had to come up with something that we could carry it around, whatever it was, in the big bags that we carried. I don't know if you all have been able to get a hold of those bags, but they didn't. Actually let us bring them home or anything like that.
Yeah.
They were reusable. So I don't know how many of them lasted through everything and were actually brought back to the States. But they were heavy, very heavy duty, big bags, flat. And so anything you used in one of my programs that I created had to do with golf. And my mother actually sent me a golf club.
Uh-huh.
With some golf balls, plastic golf balls. And we used those. The men got to actually get up and actually, we had a little cup that they were, going to try to hit the ball into that little cup. And they earned points by doing that. But they had to, we usually, things that had to do with some of the TV shows that were on back a long time ago were question and answer type of things. And things that would interest them, that were of their generation, and things that were questions that, some of the shows, like Wheel of Fortune right now, we would have had a Wheel of Fortune game, I guarantee you. Somebody would have come up with a program that had to do with Wheel of Fortune or any of the more popular game shows back there. it was just an idea of, you know, when a group of young people get together, and it just instead of just sitting around and talking, we played games together, we laughed together, and we just enjoyed each other's company, and it was good, clean fun, because it was never, we were never allowed, and we wouldn't have done anything that was risque or rude or tacky. It was just them being able to be with us, and us being able to be with them, and laughing and enjoying. And of course, we always tried to have our, you know, we always tried to look neat and clean and smell good.
Yes.
And the guys just enjoyed us, but totally respected us. It was just awesome that these young men were so, and they wanted us to come back. So they wanted to be nice to us. So they remembered all the things that Mama had taught them about how to treat a lady.
That's wonderful.
And they did. And any of them that would temporarily, like that man, that young man at Kunzan, any of them would temporarily forget, you know, who we were and who they were, they would quickly, you know, usually all we'd have to say, no, I don't feel comfortable with that. So they would back off. But we did have an occasion where one of our girls would get in trouble. And we actually, you know, had one girl we lost over there because of that. She was killed.
Yeah, I've heard about her.
But it usually involved somebody who'd had too much of something that took their mind away from them and took their self-control.
When you would visit with them when you were out doing programming, what sort of things would they talk about?
Well, you know, whenever you're sitting around with college friends and the things you talk about, it was a lot of that. Of course, so many of them got a big kick out of where I was going, where I had come from school. Blue Mountain College, you know, that was just a hoot. But a lot of them, if they were from that part of the country, they knew, you know, North Mississippi, they knew all the names of the places. They knew where First Monday was, and just a lot of things like that. But we just enjoyed each other's company, and laughed and talked, and they'd tell jokes. And of course, we'd have some things that we had learned to do that tested their physical abilities and all, and I still use some of those things after I became a teacher in the classroom. It's an amazing amount of things you can do with rubber bands on your hands, you know. And then testing strength, and of course they just love to perform for us, you know, to show us things that they could do, and of course they want to show us things that they had made. A lot of them use their knives real well and whittle things out of wood. I can remember them doing that. That was awesome. But then, of course, we'd also want to talk to them about the 155 howitzers that they used in country. Those were awesome pieces of equipment. And they'd have to explain to us, they'd want to tell us all about that and what it would do and what it was capable of doing. And of course, the helicopter pilots, some of them, they were warrant officers and they were 19 and 20 years old. And they were amazing young men, but they were flying us anywhere we needed to go. They would stop and get us, and we'd hang on for dear life. But it was, and of course, we'd have our gunners that would sit behind us, because we were on kind of like a bench seat. And they were all just young, very young.
And what was the morale of the troops in 68, particularly in regards to the Tet Offensive?
Well, I think if they could have all come home, they would have.
Yeah.
But these kids, you have to remember, at the age that we all were, our dads had been in war. And then before that, our granddads had been in war. So coming to war was just part of our responsibility of being an American citizen. It was just something that we all just did because they had done it before us, generations before us. And so this was our war. This was our experience. And we were hoping that we were doing a good job and making them proud. But no, I think, you know, we would have all come home if we could have, if we could have all ended this. But we believe that we were there fighting against communism to give those people the opportunity to be free and to live a free, a good life and not be subjected to things that we had learned in school that communism represented.
When you came under fire at Bearcat, Was that mostly at night?
Bearcat, it was at night.
Okay.
And I don't remember ever just the mortar attack.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually what we had that. And we could, you know, you could actually tell that they were literally walking the mortar across. Because this was, Bearcat was totally flat.
Uh-huh.
And so you could see they were literally picking up the mortar tubes, running with them, putting them down, dropping the mortar in, picking up the mortar tube, running, drop it again. So they would literally walk them across the base. So you never knew if it was going to hit before, after, or right on where you were, you know. In the Triangle, they actually, you know, did the same thing. And they would hit the city. Because we were not on the base in the Triangle. We were living in a house outside of the base, not very far from the beach. But I never really went to the beach. I went down to look at the beauty of the water there and the beauty of the beach, but we were just always too busy.
Yeah.
But occasionally some of the girls would have an opportunity to go down there, but our mortar attacks were at night. We had a flat roof on this house we were in, some of the girls would be up on the flat roof during the day. And if anything got started or if there was any gunfire or anything around us, they would have to come down off that roof real fast.
Yeah.
But that was a really good place to go sunbathe, you know, if you were inclined to do that. But we did have a guard there on our little gate, but the guard always seemed to disappear when there was any activity in the city. So, and we did not have any kind of weapon there in the house with us, so we would have, you know, really not had any way of protecting ourselves if anything had happened in the city. And but thank goodness nothing really ever did that we were in danger. We just had to go down and sit under our stairwell. That's where we got for protecting ourselves from mortars or from any kind of incoming. And I can remember the airplane that would fly over, attention all U.S. personnel, attention all U.S. personnel. And then they would say some things, I don't know what all they would say, about protecting ourselves, getting in a secured area, blah, blah, blah. And so we would sit there sometimes for hours underneath that stairwell. And we actually did that a week before I was leaving country. So, you know, God and I had some serious talk that day. Now, wait a minute, I'm too short for this. We got to just get me out of here.
Yeah.
But across the street from our, do you want me to talk about the crying right now? Or?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, across the street, and there's a picture of our house, and then I took pictures to the left and to the right, looking out on the street in front of our house. Across the street to the left, it was an old French bunker, and you had to take a ladder to climb up to the door of this bunker, and we would see our guys climbing up that ladder. And for the longest time, being naive like we were, we didn't understand why would our guys be going in. They were dressed in their civilian attire, and they'd be going up that ladder. Well, it turned out that bunker had been turned into a house of prostitution.
Uh-huh.
So that's why the men were going. And there was a lot of that out in the train.
Yeah, in the city.
I know there was some when we were at Bearcat, but it was actually there on the base. I think in some of the other areas where girls were serving, they were near or actually in the villages. They could see more of that happening. Then to the right of our house, there was a club up there. It was called the Press Club, and that was where members of the press would come and eat their lunch or dinner, you know, with the bar there. But they had the best ham sandwiches, let me tell you. And so we would walk up there to eat many times. But we would also see people there that we recognized from television back home.
Wow.
So I couldn't tell you now who all of them were, but I just knew I'd seen them on TV before back home. So that must have been a great place that a lot of them liked to stop as they were traveling across country reporting on the war. But we did live in a house there, a two-story. We had a shared bathroom. They called it a French villa at one time, but it wasn't anything like any kind of villa that I would. what a step it took. Yeah. But it was one of our girls that actually served there with me. This last summer, she actually went back to Metrain. She's going around country visiting all the places where she actually served, and I think her son is doing a documentary of his mother's time in Vietnam. And she wanted to go back and see that, and she asked if I had any pictures. She had forgotten what this house looked like.
Uh-huh.
So I was able to send her one of these pictures of this house. Hopefully that she was able to find it while she was there. But I know all the cities, the little villages, the cities and all, have grown tremendously since we were there, so it would have been really hard to recognize so much, but it's been almost 50 years.
Yeah. Those are two very different locations between Bearcat and
the, you know, China Beach.
Yeah.
You familiar with that program?
I am.
Well, seeing the triangle, the beach there is gorgeous. The views from off that beach are just so beautiful. I mean, it was a reward for me having been at Bearcat for so long. But I did get to see, I told you that at Bearcat, we actually got to go out and visit the Buddhist orphanage.
Yes.
I sent some pictures of that. But at Metrain, we actually got to go out and visit with the Montagnards.
Oh, wonderful.
A group that had come in out of the mountains, and they were being protected there by our military, and they were just the loveliest people. You see, we didn't get to experience too much with the Vietnamese people, because, to be perfectly honest, some of them even our own Mamazon would steal from us.
Uh-huh.
Because her belief was, if you've got two watches, you only need one.
Yeah.
So she would rid you. If you had a carton of 24 Cokes, she would take all, but the number of, that there were, if there were six of us, then she'd leave the six. And she didn't come back after 10. That Mamazon didn't. So we never found out what happened with her. But a lot of them that worked on our base, they were NVA or whatever. You know, they were the enemy. So, and we did have a POW type camp there at Bearcat. You could see it as you were flying in. It was a tended area with barbed wire all around it. We just never went around there. But it was, I guess they brought in, you know, whenever they captured anybody in the field, they would bring them in there and keep them there until they moved them somewhere else. But at Metrain, of course, there was a little bit of everything in Metrain. We had Marines there, we had Air Force there, we had Green Berets were there. It was, and of course, your big airplanes, like C-130s is what I flew out of to Saigon to catch my flight home. And anytime we got to fly on a C-130, the pilots liked to have us come and sit up front with them on the couches. And it was, I love that plane to this day. That was one of my freedom birds.
Yeah.
But getting to experience the Montagnards was wonderful. And now, right close to us here, there's a little town called Whiteville, Tennessee. And there's a group of Montagnard families that actually live in Whiteville, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Not far from here. And they have a large area out there where they're growing their crops and growing their children, and just they're living as Americans. Wonderful that they're here. But they were lovely. And while I was visiting, we were going around and seeing them in their little makeshift tent stall that they'd set up.
Uh-huh.
Apparently I dropped my camera cover from my camera. And I didn't realize it was gone until I climbed up in the Jeep to leave. And I was sitting there in the back seat, and all of a sudden this little hand tapped me on my hand. And I looked over, and it was just a little boy, and he handed me my camera cover. And that just endeared me to these people big time, because we were used to being careful around the children there in the train, because they would steal any time they could get a hold of anything.
Uh-huh.
And it was just because they just had to survive some way. And it was easy to steal from us. They would grab us around the wrist, and you would think, oh, how sweet, they want to hold my arm, you know.
Uh-huh.
No, they had a razor blade, and they would be sawing your watch off your arm. Because we all wore, we didn't wear the watches, you know, with the steel metal type bands. We always had the leather type bands because the others wouldn't last long. But they learned that they could, a couple of wicks with a razor blade, and they could cut it off your arm.
Sure.
And that was so sad for those children because they were so beautiful. They were beautiful children, and it wasn't fair that they were having to grow up in a war. I'm sure Matrang now is a tourist mecca.
Yeah.
It is so beautiful there. And I notice they do a lot of advertising online for the hotels and the trains.
Yeah, the beach looks beautiful there.
Yeah.
When you visited the Montagnards, did they have translators? Were you able to communicate with them?
Not really. I think there was somebody there, somebody from our military that talked to us about.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't mind us taking their pictures. And I think I said in what I had actually sent in to you all, I wrote about my experience there, in the service club there on base there in the train, they did have an area where you could learn how to develop your own pictures.
Yeah.
And I did learn how to do that with black and white film. And so, those were some that I actually printed, and I sent those to y'all.
Uh-huh.
And I was just quite proud of that. And, you know, I used that then in my teaching career. I was able to use my knowledge, and I got my own equipment and set up a dark room. Every school I went to, and I did yearbooks in those schools and taught those kids how to print, develop and print their own pictures. And that was just a wonderful teaching tool. But the Montagnard pictures were some of the very first that I ever did. But they were, like I said, they were lovely, lovely people, and I was just thrilled to find out that so many of them were safely able to come here to this country.
Yeah.
And then I had a student, one of my first years teaching here close to us here at school, was a seventh grade language arts teacher. I had the students write about the time that I was most afraid.
Mm.
That was their writing project. And one of my boys wrote about the time that he and his family were part of the boat people.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even realize that. I didn't know that at the time. And he wrote pages and pages of how his family had escaped in Vietnam. And it was beautiful. And I was so I could kick myself for not having kept a copy of that paper. We've had quite a few of those refugees from Vietnam who came to this area. I don't know why they picked this area, but they did. It was just wonderful. A lot of memories came flooding back. And what he had to go through and how they survived all that they went through to get out of there and then to get here. To this country.
Yeah. Did you have any interaction with the Vietnamese troops there, the Arvin?
Not really.
Uh-huh.
Not really. I'm sure there were times that we were in the same area together, but not really. But anything that I can remember. I mean, I knew they were there, and I knew who they were, but some of the girls in some other areas might have had a lot of interaction with them.
Now, in terms of your relationships with the civilians, it sounds like there was more of a relationship with the Korean civilians than there were with the Vietnamese.
Oh, much more.
Uh-huh.
Because it just wasn't safe for us. So, like I said, we never left Bearcat to go out into a civilian area. But now there were other units that the girls were able to do that. They would actually go into the village and eat, you know.
Yeah.
And just actually walk up and down the streets because the area was safe there for them to do that. And then the train, we could actually walk down to the press club and some things like that. But you just had to know
And what I read about Winifred, the Donut Dolly dog. Did you have any pets while you were there?
We did have dogs, but we had to pay. I forgot now how much we actually paid. But at the trying, we actually paid a guard to guard our dog for it. But they usually didn't stay around.
Yeah.
I sent pictures of some of the dogs we had. They didn't stay around because the people, you know, they were a delicacy.
Uh-huh.
Same thing in Korea. Some of our men, some of the officers there in the country, had dogs, but they would pay an armed guard to guard their dogs. One group of men in a Quonset hut, there were four of them living in a Quonset hut together. I remember they had a German Shepherd, and of course that was a big dog, and
yeah.
that represented to the Koreans a lot of meat. And so they had to have a guard on that dog all the time. And of course we would go out into Pyeongtaek, the village right outside the gate there at Humphrey, and we would see dog meat hanging in the windows of the butcher shop. And our mamazan, about once a week, would fix a meal for us. But one of us would be in charge of getting the meat for her to fix for us. So she would fix the typical Korean meal for us. But we had to make sure that what she was fixing was beef.
Yeah.
You know? We had to make sure it was real meat, not something she'd buy at a market out in the village. And so every once in a while that would be my responsibility to see to it that it was actually meat, beef.
Yeah.
State that. But I enjoyed traveling on the trains. That was part of the fun of being there and being with the people and meeting people. I met two girls on the train that were lovely, and I would invite them to come and visit with me, and they just were thrilled. They would get to come on base. Another lady I met, she was lovely. Her English was very good, and she invited me to come out to her house, and her house turned out to be a little L-shaped building with I don't know how many individual rooms in it for different people to live in. But when I got into her room, she had a better bed than I did.
Uh-huh.
And as it turned out, she had a baby that her mother was taking care of across the alley. And she wanted me to see her room because she was so proud of it. And her baby's father was in Vietnam, but he was coming back.
Mm-hmm.
After he left Vietnam, he was going to get her and take her to the States. And of course, bless her heart, I just hope that he did. But
yeah,
that wasn't, in most cases, what really happened. So
yeah.
She was lovely. I'm sorry, my throat is getting dry.
No problem.
But I did enjoy the people I did. I enjoyed being with them because they were lovely. The mamazons were actually, you know, would come into our area and be with us a lot more than others. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no problem.
But they were getting paid by us to do what we asked them to do as far as the cleaning and the taking care of our clothing. And our dresses didn't last very long, the blue dress, because they used the concrete floor. That's where they scrubbed them.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, eventually we had to get those replaced. And they just couldn't get over us and our ways and how many things, if anything, we had.
Yes.
It was just not practical to have that much stuff. But, oh, and when our mamas on and that Bearcat would say, she would say, Mamazan. I'd say, no, me Babyzan. No, you not Babyzan. You Mamazan. No, I'm not. Because yeah. Mamazan, I was supposed to already have children back in the States.
Yes.
But by my age, I should have had, you know, three or four.
Yeah.
This time, of course, she was concerned. We really didn't get to know them that well.
Well, I think this is a good point at which to pause and let you get some water. So I'm going to stop recording. This is Anna Snipes, and I'm conducting the second part of an oral history interview with Ms. Gloria Glover Gates. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Ms. Gates is coming to us from Eads, Tennessee. Ms. Gates, could you describe R&R that you did in Australia and other places?
Well, the first one I was able to take was to Hong Kong. And I went there and met my parents there, and we had a lovely time there. And I did some shopping at the Feet Club there and bought all of my stereo equipment, my reel-to-reel tape deck and big speakers and turntable, and I mean, I got the deluxe kit and had all of that shipped back home. And I knew about this from others who had done the same thing in previous months, and so I knew that when I went home I was going to have an outstanding sound system, and I still have most of that sound system right now in my home. I'm very proud of it.
What a treasure.
And then in Hong Kong, we did try some of the food there. We just enjoyed the sights and sounds of the city. We were not at that time able to go into the mainland, and so we had to just stand and look over into that area as we took our different trolley rides and all. We did go to an underground mall, they called it, and purchase some items there and had them shipped back. That was the nice thing, being able to have things shipped back to the States. And everything seemed to get there just fine. I still have a table with little stools that we purchased there. My mom and dad used it for many years in their home, and then I inherited it after their deaths. So it was just a wonderful time. I just remember thinking that in the main streets of Hong Kong, it was just like one of our major city streets. But then when you went back into the alleyways, it was almost like you'd gone back 500 years, because it was just totally, totally different from what you saw out on the main street. I did enjoy riding the trolley and their buses, because you got to see a whole lot more that way, and just enjoying the country while we were able to also look out over the harbor there and see some of our ships as they came in for their R&Rs. And it was just a beautiful sight to see. But I enjoyed that time, especially being with my parents. Then Australia, I was there. Actually got to go in August around my birthday time. So I enjoyed having that nice time away from country. Of course, we flew in and out with the men, as they were going on their R&Rs too, so everyone was terribly excited about getting to go. We spent a couple of days there in Sydney, and they had an opportunity for anyone who wanted to sign up to go leave Sydney and go out into the countryside and actually spend two or three days with an Australian family. I chose to do this along with the girl from my unit that I was with. And we flew about 120 miles, I believe it was north of Sydney. We were met there by a very, very precious couple who took us out to their sheep ranch. And on the way, of course, we had to stop at a little country store and buy ourselves some blue jeans and heavy shirts and light jackets, because it was very cold there. It was winter in Australia. But we did spend a few days with the family. We were able to visit their children's one-room schoolhouse, because the children there would go to school up through sixth grade, and then they would go in to school in the big city and actually live away from home for their middle school and high school experience. But we were able to tour the area. I think their sheep ranch was something like 50,000 acres, and of course we saw herds of kangaroo, and we got to experience touching kangaroo for the first time ever. We also went to the big barns where they sheared the sheep and got to watch that happening. And it was just a beautiful experience. And instead of out in our west, seeing antelope cross the highway. It was herds of kangaroo crossing the highway. But it was beautiful. The people there were wonderful to us, so sweet to us, and so kind to let us come and be in their home for that time. Of course, we did take the standard tour of Sydney and see the koala bears up close at their zoo and the opera house. It was just nice. It was like being in one of our cities in our country, so we enjoyed it very much. And we also saw anti-war folks in the parks there, and there were speeches going on pretty much the whole time we were there, anti-war type speeches, because they were just as unhappy. Some of their folks were just as unhappy about their soldiers being in Vietnam as some of our folks here at the time. So.
Uh-huh. How did you feel about the peace protesters there and at home in America?
Well, I just, at the time, being of the super patriot, because I just love this country, and I was of the opinion that whatever our government and whatever our military said we needed to do, that's what we needed to do. And I really didn't understand why these people were making so much noise. But they had their rights to do that. But the shame of it was they did not really appreciate these young men and these women who went over there as members of our military, what they did over there, and that they had served our country just as well and just as much love and care as World War II, Korea, World War I, any military we've ever had that has represented us in foreign wars. And yet they were so mistreated because there was so much protest at that time about us even being there. It was such a political thing about us being there that the people of this country developed a bad attitude.
Uh-huh. When you were in both Korea and in Vietnam, what did you do for recreation there?
Let us see, in Korea, as I said, we were able to get out more with the people. So we were able to visit in, their homes. We were able to travel by jeep or by truck, by train, and I love the trains, and see so much of the countryside and actually go into the homes of so many of the people, share meals with them, and I really did enjoy that. And we did go to Seoul at times, and that was a wonderful experience. And there was an awful lot to do there at Camp Humphreys if we wanted to participate in any of the things that they did. And I did go to church on Sunday out at the Piontek Church and shared fellowship with those people, and they were just so sweet to me, even though we didn't understand the same language. But my friend was able to interpret for me, so they would ask me questions about my home, and I would talk to them, and I would show them pictures of my family. And so I really enjoyed Korea very much. Vietnam, we didn't get to recreate that much. We really, except there in our billet, and we were safe to do things there if we wanted to. We looked so forward to R&R, and we looked so forward to girls coming back from R&R and sharing with us the things that they had done, and also buying us things when we'd give them money to do so, because pretty soon you found out, what was available out there in the different cities that we were all able to go to, and so we would give whoever was going money, and they would buy things for us. And I think most of us got a huge set of silverware that came to us in a great big wooden box, and I still have it, but it's really not too good for anything anymore, but wooden handles, and it was beautiful, but everybody just felt like they had to have one. So whoever was going to Bangkok would order these for everyone and have them shipped back to our homes back in the States. And I think at that time it cost us about $50 U.S. dollars, so that was nice. But as far as real recreation, and I'm sure in some of the areas, as I said, that the girls were able to do a lot more and go to the beach more, but of course there was no beach at Bearcat. And then at Nha Trang there was a beach, but we were so busy because we were not only going out to different areas to program, but we also were running a rec club where we had to be there all day on duty. And we spent a lot of time, I played a lot of ping pong, we played a lot of different types of cards, We just did a lot of things there in the rec club with the men.
Yeah, and you mentioned using the photo developing lab there.
Yes.
Is that something that remained with you? Did you continue doing that?
I did continue doing. This was through the service club, and I was able. They, you know, let us come over there and work in their labs and learn how to use the equipment. And when I got home, I started teaching in 1970, and I didn't use my experience in Vietnam with photography for a while until one of the teachers who did the yearbook at the high school needed some help, and so I helped her, and that's whenever I was able to acquire some equipment, set up a lab, and we were able to start developing there. And then every school I went to after that, I would take my equipment with me, and I would teach the kids that were on the staff. We learned how to develop, get better at it, and I was appreciative of having picked up that skill while I was over there. And I also found me some equipment here in the Memphis area, cheap. It was a good price. Somebody was getting rid of their stuff, and so I was able to acquire their equipment at a very low price. But it enabled me to do some things with my students in the high school and in the middle school area that I probably wouldn't have had as much of an opportunity without this skill. So I appreciate it.
Yeah. A lot of the photos that you sent us look like they're from the Buddhist orphanage near Bearcat.
Right.
Can you describe that facility more?
Well, it was, I'm sure you saw the long buildings, the children slept on, I remember, it seemed to me, just flat wooden beds. They were all pretty much dressed the same. The Buddhist monks tended to them. They were always fascinated by us. They'd never seen American women, so many of them. But they were always glad to see us because we generally took some type of little treat that they let us. And there were just so many of them. And I don't know how many are actually of these orphanages were set up all over country, but I'm sure there had to be a lot. But they seemed to be well taken care of. And of course, it was all open air. And I just thought it was strange that they were so close to our base because I didn't think that it was safe for that orphanage with those buildings full of children to be that close to one of our military bases, which, of course, the enemy seemed to want to do a lot of damage to, and I didn't. I was always afraid for the children.
Yeah.
They never did come to our base. Now, the monks did because our government, you know, our military there on the base tried to have good rapport with them. For whatever reason, but they did come and visit, but not the children.
And how much contact did you have with your family and friends when you were over there?
A lot of letters, and my mother sent a lot of care packages, which everyone loved to get to see whenever I was getting a care package, what my mother had sent next, because it was always something. We requested things from the families and units back home whenever we needed. As I told you, when we needed socks for the Mobile Riverine Force down in the Delta, we were inundated with socks. I mean, boxes and boxes of socks because in our church and in some of the schools in this area up here, they started collecting socks, any description. I mean, we even had fancy dress socks.
Uh-huh.
But the men needed them because they were literally rotting off their feet, the military issue, so they just appreciated those socks so much. But, I mean, there were things that we could not get, like hairspray. We could get hairspray in Saigon, but you had to go out on the black market, and that was really not a safe thing for us to do. So that was sent to us in the form of lacquer in boxes, special treats. And my mother always used popcorn as the packing material for whatever she sent. And we just, like I said, enjoyed the boxes with lots of letters. And then, as I told you, right after Tet, I knew that the information they were getting on the news back here was not good. It was rather scary. And so I put in a call, when it was my turn, by the way, to call home, and it was difficult because with the CB radio, the call had to go from Bearcat to Saigon to Tokyo to Hawaii to San Francisco to Las Vegas, and then to Memphis. And my poor mother, it was hard for me to understand, but it was really hard for her, that you had to literally disconnect each time you finished your sentence or whatever you say, so that all the operators across the world literally could open and close whatever they had to do, you know, for us to be able to talk. So I can just remember saying over, "Mother, you have to say over. Mother, you have to say over." So we really didn't get good enough at that to continue those phone calls. So anytime I went out of country, then I would always try to call home. That was really important. Then we could get straight connection and wouldn't have to do that.
Uh-huh. Were you exposed to the media coverage of the war while you were there?
If I was, I didn't know it.
Uh-huh.
There was more going on, I think, at Cameron Bay, because whenever anyone really important in our government would come to Vietnam, they would always come through Cameron Bay, and they would make appearances there, and there would be a lot of the news there. I told you we would go in the triangle, we would always go down and eat sometimes at the press club, because they had awesome ham sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a good place to be, and a lot of times you would recognize people from the news back home when they would come in and eat too. I just remember that we recognized them, but we really didn't know who they were. And of course, I'm sure some of them later became famous, and you know, the world knew them then as some of our own press folks. But we weren't really enthralled with them at that time. You know, it didn't. But never, we were never. I was never interviewed or part of a group that was interviewed or anything like that. That didn't happen.
When you returned, what did you think of the media coverage that you saw in America?
Well, I guess it was okay. I don't remember that much. I just don't think that I watched the news that much.
Uh-huh.
Because a whole lot of it was somebody would come over and they would film for 2 or 3 days, and then they'd put something together for the Today Show or something like that. And there was a time, I think, while I was there that Red Cross workers were actually featured on one of these things that they showed on the Today Show. His mother talked to me in a letter about actually seeing that and wondering why I wasn't a part of that, why I could not have gotten on that report so she could see me. And it was taped somewhere far away from where we were, so I had to explain to her that it just didn't happen, that I was at the right place at the right time. But I think it just depended on what part of the country that you were from. And of course, I came home to the South, and everybody here was just, they were so hungry for information from somebody who had actually been there and done that. And they were just so gracious. We didn't see anybody down here in this area that was protesting or was ugly. And so I really didn't pay attention to the news that much. I was just too busy, because I almost immediately had to start sharing and speaking. And I did that a lot the first year I was home.
And what did you think of Vietnam, physically speaking, the country itself?
Well, I thought it was and still is a beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to do a lot of flying over that country in helicopters, open-door helicopters. And so I got the best view of this country. And I went from the Delta area, which is so much submerged underwater and so flat and all, I mean, it was just beautiful there. And then you get to go up to the Trang, and out from the Trang, it was mountainous there. And of course, the beautiful, beautiful beaches, and the water there is just beautiful off in the Trang. I just remember thinking then, this would be so beautiful if people in the States could come here for vacation and see this gorgeous country.
Yeah.
And what's happening to it. And of course, as you would fly over the Delta area and up to Bearcat, you would see how much the countryside had been pockmarked by the B-52 bombers, because everywhere you looked, you would see where the bombs had been dropped and just blown large holes in all the fields. But that was part of, I guess, what our military was having to do. But it was, I just couldn't get over how beautiful the country was. Now, Saigon, I don't think so. Saigon was not what it is today, because I have since seen pictures of Saigon. And at the time when I was there, it was a smell to it that was unbelievable. And then it's just so much of the city had been ravaged by war. And there were so many areas that had been literally destroyed. And, of course, there were poor, very, very poor sections of the city. And then there were areas where, obviously, money was available to these people, and they had built nice buildings, nice homes, whatever. And, of course, around our embassy and in those areas, it was some nice streets. But it was still a war-ravaged city. And so I didn't look forward to getting to go to Saigon for any reason. And we would fly through there a lot of times on the way to our different areas where we were programming.
Uh-huh. Did you fly through Saigon when you left the country, when you went back?
Yes, we had to go back to Tantanut.
Uh-huh.
I had to leave from the Trang, and I left on a C-130, and they flew me to Saigon. This is my memory now, but I can remember. I have a picture of my airplane. I think I sent it.
Uh-huh.
I was standing there in the terminal area waiting for our announcement for us to board, and it was a Braniff, a yellow Braniff, the most beautiful airplane I've ever seen in my life. And there were flight attendants on there. I guess that they had volunteered for these trips. And once we boarded, we were going home, and everybody was just thrilled. And they passed out almost immediately. I can remember fresh, soft bread, stateside bread, and milk, real milk. And I've never seen so much milk and so much bread eaten in my life. Because the bread we would get was not the soft Wonder Bread like we were used to back home, you know. So
yeah.
It was great to get this good, soft bread. I don't remember eating or drinking anything else on that plane but milk and bread.
How did you feel when you left?
Well, we were all excited because we were all so homesick. And I know so many of those men, I thought about the men that I had flown over with from Tokyo as I came into country. How many of them actually, a year later, got to leave, got to come back.
Yeah.
And, as we did at the time I was there in 68, we were losing a lot of our men. And it just got to be just an everyday fact, the KIA numbers. But it was wonderful to be leaving, but you felt really proud of what you had done, that you'd been there with these awesome men, because they were some of the finest men I've ever had the privilege of working with.
And how was your transition back to civilian life after your time over there?
Well, I think it was pretty good. You know, I didn't know about all of the stuff that could be, you know, could happen to you as a result of being over there. So
mm-hmm.
I don't think any of it did happen to me. I think that I just got right into what I needed to do for the rest of my life, and things pretty well fell into place. And I went, of course, visited family and friends until till January of 1969, and by that time I had been asked to work at my college as a recruiter, because the president of my college saw a great value in me, because I was being asked to speak everywhere.
Yeah.
And at the same time, see, I could throw in some pronouncements about my school.
Yeah.
And do some recruiting, and so I spoke at a lot of high schools in Mississippi, all the way from the Gulf Coast back up to North Mississippi, and I spoke to lots of churches and lots of groups, and it was just a wonderful opportunity to share what was going on over there. And naturally, all the mothers and dads wanted to know about the environment their sons were in as they were over there, and what was going on with them as much as I could tell them. And so they were just, it was just a wonderful experience. These people were just so sweet and kind, and I didn't see a war protester. We did experience some negativity as we came in to San Francisco. There's the base. Because we were told, I don't know who was speaking, the pilot or whoever, but they advised that as soon as we offloaded that we needed to change into our civilian clothes. And we really didn't appreciate why, you know, at that time. But it would be better if we would leave the area, the base there, in our civilian clothes. So that's what we did. And I went and resigned from the Red Cross there at the headquarters in San Francisco, and was on a flight the next day. And I actually paid a little extra money so I could sit in first class on my airplane going home, because I thought I owed that to myself.
Certainly.
And I want you to know that the flight attendants, as they were serving meals, got to talking with me. And they found out where I had just come from and what I had been doing. And they got so enthralled in our conversation. Of course, I did too. I didn't get my meal that I had paid extra for. So by the time we landed in Memphis, I was still hungry. But see, I was just, you know, it was just so much fun to talk with people, because they were just the first person, I guess, beside the news that actually been able to talk to much about it. And I was more open and willing to talk, I think, than a lot of the men were. A lot of the men had had such horrible experience that they really didn't want to talk about.
Yeah.
Which I think would have been better had they done so.
Yeah.
I will tell you that when we left the base there in Saigon, we took off and flew. First, we had to land in Tokyo, of course, to refuel. And in the refueling, we found out that someone was going to have to get on the plane going back to the States with us, because they had been, somehow they had been, it was determined this was a civilian employee who was going to Saigon to work for a company there, and they had discovered that he had some kind of health problem, and he needed to go back to the States. So I didn't know who he was. I didn't see him go down the aisle or anything. So he gets on the plane, he goes to the back, sits down apparently, and then we take off from Tokyo. And of course, In that flight to San Francisco, you kind of have to go up near Alaska. And as we were flying, all of a sudden, the pilot comes on and says, we're going to have to make an emergency landing because one of our passengers has become ill. And then all of a sudden, the oxygen masks fall down. Mm-hmm. And this man has had a seizure. Mm-hmm. And we have some medics on the plane, and they were able to help him. But we had to land at ADOC in the Aleutian chain.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do so, we had to abort all the fuel on the plane, because it was a very short runway. And so the pilots maneuvered that plane down, and we landed. And we had to get off the plane. And, of course, they took the man who was ill. They took him off and took him, I guess, to their local little infirmary. And I don't know how long we were on the ground, but a lot of folks were able to make long-distance calls home to their families and let them know they were going to be late. But I just remember how cold it was, because, of course, we were all dressed for summer, for warm weather. And when we took off, the runway was really, really short. And so it was hard for that big airplane to take off on that little runway. And also, it was very difficult for the pilots to get the engine started again. I don't remember exactly what it was, but one of the things was because of the humidity or the air up there where we were. I've never been to Alaska, but that was my one experience actually being there. Then we took off. I think they thought that one of the landing gear had grazed the landing lights at the end of the runway, because at the end of the runway there was the ocean, but they were able to fly around the tower there in San Francisco at the base there. I forget the name of that base there in San Francisco, but they were able to check and make sure that nothing had been damaged. We landed, and so that was our go home. We just didn't do a normal trip. We had to make a stop. So we all safely arrived in San Francisco and then safely arrived home.
Good thing. Why do you think that the U.S. was involved in Vietnam?
Well, from everything that I had read and heard from the news at that time while I was still in college, it was communism.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I had been raised in an era of time when we didn't want any country to have to be under communism because of all that it represented and all that it did to the people of that country. And basically, that's what it was. And of course, we were seeing pictures and hearing stories of the things that were happening to the people there. And so we just didn't think that any country, any people, should be oppressed like that and have to live under that, the horror of communism, what it could be.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about what we were trying to accomplish there?
Well, I think if we had been able to do what we the people thought that we were doing over there, then it would have been okay. But since having been there and since having read so many things that have come out about Vietnam and seeing all the documentaries and all that, I realized that there was a whole lot of money made on that war, and there was a whole lot of sacrifice being made by so many of our peoples here, sending their sons off to war. But they did the same thing with all the wars we've ever fought. They believed so much, as I did, in what our government said, that we were a government that would never lie to its people and that we would always do what was right and good. And I just, I think that we were misled in some areas. It's very, very shameful, you know, that some of the things that happened as a result of the war. And, of course, when I came back from the war, my first, in the early years after I came home, we became very involved in the POW situation.
Yeah.
And so many of our students, we wore the bracelets and we read about all of them and prayed for them. And we were just very, very, very thrilled when they were able to come home. And of course, since then, there have been so many more books, and I've read as many of those books, what those men went through over there.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of our men were captured over there, and so much was done to them because of who they were and what they represented. But I think we went over there with good intentions, the troops, all of us that went, but I'm not so sure about our government. But I know that all that I dealt with, all of the young men and the nurses, all the women that were there, everybody was there for because our country had always answered the call to help others. And I think that's why our country has always been so blessed, because we were always willing to do unto others. And we just, I think it was shameful that so many of the men that I visited with in the hospitals, their number one complaint was that our government always seems to have to ask the South Vietnamese government if they can do something. I mean, I visited with one young man who was burned terribly, and I know he's carried those scars the rest of his life, but they wanted to go ahead and open fire on a particular area, and they had to get permission not only from our military, but our military had to get permission from the government and the military in Saigon. Why, he kept saying, why do they have to give us this? Let us come in and do what we do best, and we could take care of this. We could defeat this. And you'd asked me the other day if I had anything to do with the Korean soldiers, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there, and they would sometimes come to Bearcat. I can remember them being there. But the joke was always, if we just let them start off and line them up and let them start off in the Delta, and they'd work their way right up to the DMZ, they would wipe out the Viet Cong. And, you know, there would be no questions asked. They would just take care of it, and they wouldn't ask permission if they could. And I wish that our government and our military could have had that attitude, that we've come to help you, so now leave us alone and let us do it. But our country seems to do that a lot. We seem to ask permission, I think, more than we should. Because I don't believe we asked permission too much in World War II.
Yeah.
I think we did what we do best.
And were you aware of where you fit in that bigger picture of the politics and diplomacy?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. I mean, we were just there to serve whatever the needs were, you know, of our troops. And I just enjoyed being with those guys and hoping to make things a little bit better for them, a little bit easier for them. Because each time we would go back to a place that we had been a week or two before, some of those guys weren't there anymore, and it was just heart-wrenching. And so we would just always hope that whatever we did 2 weeks ago or a week ago had made it a little bit better for them during that time. Every letter we would write, or every card game we would play with them, or ping pong, or socks we would take to them, or some kind of a munchy candy that had been sent from home. It was just anything to just make it a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a pretty easy year for us compared to what some of them were having to go through. So that was not politics. And we didn't see anybody as a Democrat or Republican or as a protester or whatever. I mean, it was, and then, of course, we did run across a lot of civilians who were over there working for civilian organizations like us, but they were doing things. As I told you, I met a girl on the plane coming back, I believe it was from Hong Kong, who was an embassy employee. And I was not able to get back to Bearcat until the next day, and so she invited me to come and stay in her apartment overnight. And so she was just, I mean, there were a lot of us over there for various reasons, but I think we were all there for the same. I mean, this is our country, and we're there to do whatever we can do to get this thing over with as quickly as possible so all of us can go home. But we want to win this, too. We do not want to just walk away.
And what are your thoughts about Vietnam today?
Well, I'll tell you. The thing that I am most proud of is that this place, and of course this, I told you that at the time I was there, the Saigon was not a beautiful city. It was rather ugly. Well, since then, the pastor of my church and many of the men and women of our church have been to Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City, and it's been a wonderful thing to see all of their videos of what they were able to do there. And I'm thinking to myself, here, this city is where I was how many years ago, and it was war-torn. There were some horrible things happening. They were being mortared and bombed all the time, and there was death in that city every day. And here we are now, you know, the pastor of my church and a large group helping to build churches, helping to set up schools and seminaries. I mean, it's just such a total transformation, and I'm just so happy that that's been able to happen over there. But we did have a missionary that came and spoke to our church about a year ago, and he shared with us that all of the Vietnam vets can be proud of the fact that while our military was there, they were still able to have church, have the people be able to come to church openly and do what they were able to do there, their mission organization. They wouldn't have been able to at that time without our troops being there. But then since then, they've been able to open up quite a number of churches across the country, and even a training school for their young preachers. So I think it's doing great, and I'm marveling at the advertisements now that I see even on the internet for people to come to Nha Trang, and it's become a beautiful tourist city and beautiful hotels, and they talk about all the restaurants there now, and I'm sure that's true all over the touristy areas of the country. I mean, it's just a gorgeous country, and the people now have learned that it's okay, I think, to let people come in and visit your country and share what you have. And there's a lot of money there now. I think, and that's wonderful for the people if the money's being passed down to the people. But it looks to me like things are going good for them over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably what we had always thought we would like to see, but it didn't happen under our time there.
Yeah. How did you feel in April of 1975 when Saigon fell?
Well, it was very sad. It was very sad what was happening. I mean, and how we had to get out of there. Of course, it would have been much better if everybody could have known what time they needed to show up at Thompson Newton, board their plane, and leave. But literally our last troops were running for their lives.
Yeah.
And from the baby lift to our last troops leaving from the pictures of those leaving the embassy, that was just so tragic. And then the people that were left behind who had really befriended us and been so near and dear to so many of our people there. And they had to be left behind, and we don't know what happened to some of them because they were our friends.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who are looking for people over there still and can't find them.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful that a lot of Vietnamese were able to come to this country and have seemed to have done really well here. And it's a shame when a country doesn't appreciate, or the government doesn't appreciate, what wonderful people that they have, what talented people that they have with awesome abilities. And they've had to come here, but we get to reap the reward of that.
Yeah.
But we get to have these wonderful people here, just like any of the refugees that have come into this country. And I have even taught children, refugee children. So it's been just such a pleasure to see that their resiliency and that they were able to come and continue their life. It's just such a shame that they weren't able to do so in their homeland. But now they can go back if they want to, I'm assuming, because we can go. Because a lot of the girls have gone back just to see. But
would you like to go back?
I don't think so. I'm of that age now, I know some of the girls, when they left Vietnam, they did take the time to backpack across Europe. But I wanted to go home.
Yeah.
I have since done that with a school group. I have gone around 21 major cities tour with a school group. But it was a wonderful opportunity to do that. And we've traveled a lot in this country. But I just have had no desire to go back, because really, Bearcat, you really wouldn't want to. If you look at the pictures of Bearcat, you'll see there really wasn't anything to go back to see.
Yeah.
And the trying, yes, but because of the type of city that it was. But I'll just leave it up to the tourist.
Do you feel that the donut dollies made a difference over there?
I think they did. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that we did. And for these guys that we visited in the hospitals and all, they could look around and see us coming and spending some time with them, and them being the center of our attention. And that was very important, I think, that while we were there, whether it was sitting in their foxhole with them, or they were always very proud to show us things that they had built, or things that they had done, something they'd whittled. And they were always giving us little things. Whatever, something that they had gotten. I still have the hollowed out inside, or the outside, I should say, of a mortar that one of the guys gave me. And he just wanted me to have something, and that's all that he had. But they were always, I got an NVA flag, and somewhere along the line of in one of my speaking trips, I lost it.
Oh, no.
I don't know what happened to it. But little things like that they would give us. But they were just so appreciative of us being there, and they didn't have anything else to give us. But they were the center of our attention, whoever we were talking to or visiting with for the time that we were there. We even went to the infirmaries there on the ships, and we saw all types of guys there. But at Quezon, after Quezon happened, we saw a lot of Marines from there at the infirmary there at Nha Trang, and a lot of them were really, really sick. They really had some serious injury. wherever we were, my number one emphasis was they were the center of attention, you know, I wasn't. So I think listening to them and sharing with them when they would ask us questions about my home and our family. But then every once in a while, one of them would fuss at us for even being there.
Yeah.
That it was dangerous. Why
yeah.
are we there? And I so appreciated them when they would do that. They were looking out for their ladies, you know, and I appreciated that. But they were so young. I mean, really so young. Even the pilots, I could not get over the age of the pilots that flew us around, down in the Delta particularly, because they were just my brother's age, and that
yeah.
was scary.
Yeah. How do you feel that your experience in Vietnam has influenced your opinion on events afterwards and current events?
Well, so much that I know about what happened in our country before me,
mm-hmm.
of course, was from the history books and told to me from family that had lived during those experiences, and what happened during Vietnam, of course, I was a little more knowledgeable about, and what's happened since then. I just still, it just makes me unhappy to realize, finally, as I did not long after the war, that our government, for whatever reason, some of the things that they were trying to sell the people of this country were just not true.
Mm-hmm.
It was just the whole reason that we were in the war in the first place. I don't think we were told the truth. And it just marvels to me to this day how we would put somebody in such authority over so many and so much who have no right to be in that authority because they have not done anything to acquire the expertise to be there. It's scary to me after seeing what I saw over there, that only the best and the brightest, the smartest, who have the experience and the knowledge should be given the responsibility of sending us to war and then directing us in that war. And so when I heard that we were sending, I know why, you know, we got involved in Vietnam, what happened there. And so when they say that they're sending in some advisors back again over to the part of the world we seem to be having a lot of trouble with now, it's scary to me. Do they know what they're doing? And do they know what we might be setting ourselves up for? And sometimes it bothers me in this country why some people are given the authority they are.
You mentioned that you had read books.
Sorry.
No problem.
Sorry.
You mentioned that you had read books about POWs. Did you read any other books on Vietnam?
Did I read books on Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
No. Mostly it's been, because I've been, for so many years now. Let me get a drink just a minute.
Okay.
I'm getting dry again. For so many years, really there weren't a lot of things to read, except articles, you know, magazine articles and whatever. But the POWs, when they came home, they began to write books about their experience. Sorry. Then there's been a lot, seems like, in the last 10 or 15 years that they've been written. And even books today are coming out. I'm reading one right now on Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite interesting, his involvement in the withdrawal of our troops and,
mm-hmm.
and finally the peace treaty and all over there. But that's what I say, when you read stuff like that, it's good to know our history, but yet it makes you very sad and sometimes it makes you very angry.
Yeah.
That those kind of decisions were made behind the scenes like that cost lives. And it's really, really sad. And, you know, we're going to always have the debate over whether we should be involved in something or not. But we have always left it up to those that we felt like were looking out for what was best for this country and for those who were trying to help.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we know now that that was not always true, really. That because we all love this country so much, and all of us had been raised by parents, grandparents, who had been involved in wars. So this was just another thing that, as we were members of this family, we were just, this is what we were going to do. And myself, my cousins, my brother, we all got into the military because it was our time. And we never suspected that maybe some of this was not very well thought out.
Yeah. How about movies or TV shows about Vietnam? Have you watched any?
Well, not really. I really haven't. I've known there's been some movies made, but, you know, that's still Hollywood's interpretation.
Yes.
No, I really haven't done that. Not because I was afraid I would something would happen as a result of me watching it. No, I don't think so. I was very blessed, and my the folks that I got to come home to and the people that I got to share my experiences with, if you want to call that debriefing, I got a good debriefing when I came home because I was able to speak and share to so many groups and to so many people. And it was a privilege to do so, but it sure helped me leave all that behind.
Have you visited the wall, the Vietnam War Memorial?
Yes. Oh, yes. But see, I was part of taking a group of students, 56, to Washington. We did the whole tour, and of course, the wall was one of the places we went. We've had the wall, the traveling wall, to actually come here a couple of times, so I went one of the times to it there. And then when they dedicated the women's memorial, I was there for that because they invited us all to come. And we were able to stay in the same hotel together, and we were able to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my experience. And then in 2010, I was able to take my niece and stepmother to see the wall because we were in at Annapolis. Our nephew was graduating from the Naval Academy. And we got to see the World War II Memorial. Never had seen that. And that was just beautiful. I just think all of that mall there in that area is just, it's just so beautiful. Be there to see all that and see that World War II memorial. That's what I grew up with.
Yeah.
Hearing all those stories and seeing all those movies Friday night with John Wayne and all. And then to actually get to be, and of course I did see the Green Beret movie that John Wayne made.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I was actually with Green Berets in the train. So that was a special privilege.
Do you believe that the U.S. government took care of its personnel in Vietnam and currently?
I think that they're better treated now than they were. I
mm-hmm.
think the resupply was not as good, but I'll tell you, we had those who were in charge militarily of resupplying our troops in different areas. There were some groups that seemed to get more than others. And just like the Sox and the Delta, I just remember fussing. That just made me so mad that those guys would come in with riverboats, and they had been out there in such danger. That was the last thing they needed to have to worry about was clean socks. They should have had brand new socks all the time. I didn't understand why. In some of the areas where I was, and of course even at Bearcat, they seemed to have a ton of stuff. But then you'd go out to the troops out in the field, and their socks were rotting off their feet, or their boots were rotting away, or, you know, I think their clothing, they should have taken better care. But then there was somebody in charge of that, and whoever was in charge of that should have seen to it. That should have been their number one priority. I do know that the Trang, we seem to be able to trade things with whoever was in charge of that. It's like we needed an ice maker, and And we were able to trade some things that we had there at the rec hall. We were able to trade something that we had there, a large quantity, to get an ice maker. And that happened a lot between the different groups over there. They were able to trade things if they needed something else. Well, what do you got that I need, and what do I have? So that kind of thing was going on over there. But I think it was perfectly legitimate. I don't know. But then I think there was also a lot of stuff that shouldn't have been going on. But I wasn't privy to that. I stayed away from any of that stuff. Now, what we did, the Red Cross, they weren't a part of that. None that I ever was. We would trade things, though, sometimes to get the things that we needed.
Yeah. Have you or your children suffered from any Agent Orange-related illnesses?
Well, you see, we're not sure what those illnesses or problems should be.
Yeah.
Because you can blame a whole lot of things on Agent Orange if you want to. But I don't know if something that has happened to us is because Mama was exposed to Agent Orange or just simply because it was something genetically that was going to happen in the family.
Mm-hmm.
So see, we just really don't know. But we do have a group somewhere here in the South of Army veterans who are saying now that there seems to be a lot of thyroid problems amongst their children because of their Agent Orange exposure. And I mean, I know that Bearcat was a switched off flat area because of Agent Orange.
Yeah.
And the surrounding area. And I know that the tanks that our water came in had been used before the water was spinning them for. That's what Agent Orange came in.
Yeah.
And so they just reused the tank. Some of the people that were in charge of moving the water around the base were not too sharp as far as what should and should not have been in that tank before they put water in it. But some of them were just 18-year-old kids, too. So they just didn't realize that what they were doing could cause some serious exposure to something. But because we didn't know about Agent Orange back then. We knew what it smelled like.
Yeah.
We could tell, you know, when we were downwind of it, but there was a lot of that. Of course, being next to the helipad, there was always the dust there that we would sometimes wake up and it would be in our mouth. There was a lot of landing during the night. Like I said, we've had some medical situations in the family. I have a daughter that has a pretty bad thyroid problem.
Mm.
But was it caused by Agent Orange? I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
You'll never know. And I have had a brain tumor.
Mm.
And that was in 07. But I was also exposed back as a teenager when they were doing testing out in Mexico, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I mean, so many of us were in that time. And I can remember my mother having us come in because they had said on the news that morning that there would probably be a cloud from that testing passing over the Memphis area.
Wow.
So we needed to kind of stay inside for a while. So that was just very common back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were doing so much above ground testing.
What do you think the most important things that you learned while you were serving?
Most important thing, let's see. That's a stumper.
Yes, that's
I know
a,
I
that's
did.
A big
I know
question.
I learned things. I know I became braver than I thought I was.
Uh-huh.
I became nervier. I didn't take as much off of before I had gone over there. A lot of times, you know, I would not stand up for myself as much as I did while I was there and after I got home. And then, of course, the things that I did while I was over there, the fact that my girls reminded me when I was telling them no about the things when they were just going into college age, well, Mother, remember where you were at 22.
Yeah.
What you were doing. So when I look back on the things that I did and the places that I was able to go to, I'm thinking, well, you know what, that was pretty big of me to do that.
Yes.
That was brave. So I think you learn a lot about yourself and what you are capable of doing. and then the fact that I began to speak in front of large groups and all, and never would have thought to do that beforehand. But then I learned a lot about the workings of our military, and I still, you know, appreciate them so much, and we still are a military family. And so I'm just very proud of what our military has been able to do under terrifically bad circumstances at times. And if the politicians would get out of the way, we might be able to take care of what's happening over there right now real quick.
Yeah.
But we'll always have these politicians that have to interject what they think. And I have the same thing that happened to me as I've gone through so many years of teaching and now retired, in that there was always somebody else off somewhere else who had never actually been in the classroom making decisions for us. And that was always and has always been so frustrating for teachers. Well, I think the same thing about our military, that here they have trained these people for how many years, for how much money, gotten them to be the best in the world, and then they tie their hands behind their back until some politician decides what's best for them to do. And I don't appreciate that at all.
Yeah. How do you feel about your service overall?
Oh, I'm very proud that I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Very proud. And I'm honored whenever I see any of those who served, when they walk around with a shirt on or a cap on that indicates they were in Vietnam. But then before that, I was I helped with one of our Christmas productions at church, and they were feeding us a light supper one night down in the basement area, and a gentleman came and sat down across from us, and I looked up, and he was World War II vet, and so I started talking to him, and he had been at D-Day. He had been one who had landed at D-Day, and I thought, I'm in awe. I'm sitting here across from this man. What an honor. And I've always been that way about our military, and to be with these people who went and did this when our country asked them to go, or made them go in some instances. But it's just an honor to be with them for what I know that they went through, because I had the privy of actually knowing what they went through by having been there in Vietnam.
Yeah. Is there anything else you would like to add? Any other thoughts?
Not really. I just, like I said, I'm just very blessed that I was able to do what I did. And there was, you know, everything you do in your life, it's just not by chance you were able to do it. You were able to do it because that was what you were supposed to do and where you were supposed to be, doing what you were doing at that time. And I know we helped a lot. I know that we were able to do some good things. And we went over there with good intentions. All of us did. We were there for what we thought was going to be, what would be best for those that we tried to help over there. And it was just an awesome opportunity to be able to do it.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time and sharing your experiences with us.
Well, I appreciate you letting me do this very much.